Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Have a quick look at what is making the headlines today, and there is plenty of variety in the news headlines this morning. Risk of attack by extremists is substantial. That's the lead in the Sunday Times, which says that the Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris, has increased the threat level posed by violent political extremists from moderate to substantial, meaning that an attack is likely following an upsurge in threat to kill members of government and opposition parties by far-right extremists. The lead is written by John Mooney, who reports that the Department of Justice was informed of the development in a confidential letter sent to Justice Minister Helen McEntee by Commissioner Harris. Bank of Ireland faces battle over €500 million crash-era pension curbs. That's the lead for the Sunday Business Post. The bank has rejected calls to lift crisis-era curbs that significantly restrict the pension benefits of more than 5,000 former staff who want the restrictions to be dropped now that the bank's pension fund has returned to surplus and the lender is now enjoying record profits of more than €2 billion. For the Sunday Independent, it's O'Gorman to resist legal bid by survivors of baby homes. The paper reports that Children's Minister will contest a series of legal challenges taken by some former mother and baby home residents who are challenging their exclusion from the government scheme, which could, the paper says, exceed €1 billion if they succeed in their legal actions. There is, of course, widespread coverage this morning of yesterday's court appearance by a 16-year-old boy who was charged with assaulting Army Chaplain Father Paul Murphy at Renmore Barracks last Thursday night. The Irish Mail on Sunday leads with the appearance by the boy in the Children's Court, where Judge Gerard Furlong refused bail because of what the judge described as the extreme seriousness of the case and the strength of the evidence. The teenager cannot be named because he is a juvenile, and because he has now been formally charged and detained, we will be unable to discuss the circumstances of the attack or the background of the teenager in any detail this morning. But it is the lead too for the Irish Sunday Mirror, which, like many of today's papers, also carries images of lots of revellers, famous and not so famous, at Electric Picnic. And I hope those of you waking up this morning in Stroud Valley aren't too foundered waking up in those tents with the weather this morning. The Sunday World leads with cartels jail bait. Nicola Tallant reports that several men connected to the Kinahan cartel were disciplined after dishing out what she described as so-called jail justice to another prisoner at Portlaoise prison. The prisoner was subjected to an assault on the same day that 11 prisoners were rushed to hospital after a mass drugs overdose. And staying with prisons across the IRC, the Observer reports that the jailing of hundreds of rioters in England has pushed prison towards full capacity. Meanwhile, the Sunday Telegraph leads with a report that extreme misogyny is to be treated as terrorism for the first time to combat the radicalisation of young men online. Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, has ordered a review of Britain's counter-terrorism strategy and will look at tackling violence against women and girls in the same way as Islamist and far-right extremism, amid warnings that misogynistic influencers are radicalising teenage boys online, not before time. Well, I suppose I should introduce you to my newspaper panel. They are today Colm O'Gorman, human rights campaigner and Irish Examiner food columnist, Killian Woods, senior business reporter with the Business Post, Ciara Murphy, European Migration Network at the ESRI, and Louise Bayliss, Focus Ireland and founder of single parent organisation Spark. You're all very, very welcome, and of interest, you all chose that lead story in the Sunday Times. Colm, it's interesting that obviously it has been reported, but it's interesting that the Garda Síochána now consider far-right extremism to pose a more serious threat than international jihadist terrorism and violent dissident republicanism, given the rapid spread across the country and its ability to attract support from people from all walks of life who are often recruited on social media platforms.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece. I mean, I don't think it should come as a particular surprise. I mean, the idea that that an attack might be likely from such extremists will come as no surprise to anybody who's witnessed the increasing levels of violence that we're seeing being used by these extremists. I mean, what do you call petrol bombing during riots. These are acts of very significant violence that we've seen, and actually I think in some ways that we've almost become a little bit inured to over the last little while, which is deeply, deeply shocking. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a surprise, but I think it's a good development that it seems it's now being taken very, very seriously. I mean, in the same piece, John Mooney writes that the so-called movement's ability to encourage people to engage in spontaneous writing, organise arson attacks and issue death threats on social media, often in their own name. I mean, that's a really notable piece here. We've now gotten to a point where individuals feel enabled and emboldened to be able to make direct threats of violence and death threats towards named individuals using their own names on social media, and there doesn't seem to be any particular response, or there hasn't been up until this point.
Ciara, a bit like climate change, sometimes when we see these kind of the rise in far-right violence, we think that it's over there, it's in other countries where politicians have been attacked or murdered, as they have been right across Europe, and including Joe Cox, obviously, in 2016 in the UK. But you've actually worked in counter-terrorism in Switzerland. What do you make of the development reported today?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because I didn't work in counterterrorism. I worked in something called preventing violent extremism.
Which, as we now know, is now being regarded as a form of terrorism.
Well, it's way more interesting than that. And I think exactly this point that other countries have been dealing with this for a long time. And obviously Ireland has its own history with terrorism, but have been dealing with this kind of this violent extremism within its population for a long time. And there's been quite a few different international responses. And one of them is this counter-terrorism response, this police-based, justice-based, prison-based, you know, trying
criminal
to criminalize it,
based.
Basically, or militarize in a lot of international contexts. And basically what happened is a lot of them realized that it wasn't really working. What you do sometimes when the criminal justice system is a really important part of the story. But sometimes what you do is you create martyrs. And often one of the goals of terrorism is to try to make the state overplay its hand so that it delegitimizes the state. And so this is why I also chose, there was a piece in the Sunday Business Post about the UK's response to the riots and how kind of, you know, swiftly the criminal justice system came into play.
But it's also reporting on the very same pages that they're going to have to empty. They're actually going to release some people early and letting people out
prisons.
In bail because of that response.
Yeah. And I think, so basically kind of what happened is that people said, okay, well, this doesn't seem to be working very well. So how do we actually complexify this? And I think Ireland is in a great situation in a lot of ways in that it's coming to these things late. So it can learn from other people's mistakes. And I think what's really interesting about, you know, the front piece of the Sunday Times is it's very much a police-based conversation at the moment. And what Preventing Violent Extremism did is they basically said, well, what are the root causes? What are the structural causes? Why do people join these groups, and can we start to tackle those? So the organization I worked with kind of worked within a framework, and we worked in very different situations. So I worked in Somalia, Nigeria, Mali, like different, you know, very different contexts. But based on a massive amount of research and literature, which does exist internationally on why people join these groups, you know, we looked at things like a sense of political efficacy. If people don't feel that there is a way to make a change and to impact their society and their politics in a legitimate way, they start to turn to other ways, but also kind of economic opportunities, a sense of purpose and community and belonging.
So a lot of the disenfranchisement, you know, feeling alienated. But Cillian, I wanted to bring you in just because in the piece it says that what is going to be the likely impact of this? So we might have to see additional protection afforded, not just to members of the cabinet, opposition leaders for government buildings, but also possibly the judiciary, you know, that it may be extended, that we might have to fund grants to politicians to buy panic alarms, install extra security features in their homes and places of work. So there are consequences. This is not just the consequence of moving from moderate to substantial is going to have real impacts.
Yeah, there's been a steady escalation of this in political quarters in recent years about upping the amount of security around ministers, especially cabinet. And that's because of some maybe I suppose, quite lower level interjections by people in society going up and throwing out was a slushy or a smoothie on Leo Varadkar. And that is like, I suppose, the low level we're at the moment, but worried that what could that escalate to if that's the sort of access, and that's how easy people see who actually want to cause physical violence to us. There's a physical element to that, but serious physical harm, that this is how easy it is to access them. Like, it's, we're at that stage clearly from this. The Gardaí are saying that they feel that this is significant enough, they have to interject to write to as a Helen McEnany, right to say this is how serious it's gotten, this is how serious we're escalating it to. What seems to be interesting though in John Mooney's piece in the inside of Sunday Times is kind of saying how Drew Harris admitting how they're not kind of prepared to tackle this, or not, they kind of will struggle to tackle this, and how there's a minimal amount of planning in some of these attacks. Okay, and that seems to be what they really will struggle with. We saw that in Coolock where there was a guard, there was a response very quickly on the ground to when there was a removal of that protest outside the facility, and then all of a sudden thousands of people were there.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Louise, in that piece by Colm O'Burke and John Lee in the Irish Mail on Sunday, just to give people an indication, we've probably all seen it, but one of the tweets was somebody on X, formerly known as Twitter, wrote, "People need to petrol bomb, brackets, bomb emoji, those migrants' centres, and take down the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Green Party government, brackets, angry face emoji. It's time for a general election, tricolour emoji, or civil war, clenched fist emoji." And I guess, you know, we see these things, you know, on social media, but obviously they have impacts, you know, calling on people to petrol bomb trucks to destroy building sites.
They have absolute massive impacts. And the Institute of Strategic Dialogue did a report back in, I think it was October, just before the riots came in, and they analysed social media tweets in a period from 2021 to 2022, I think, about maybe an 18-month period. And they were analysing it, and they could see how this was spreading through the likes of X or Instagram, or they were saying actually TikTok wasn't spreading as much. But they went through all the different social media posts, and they were saying how quickly it was escalating. It started with COVID and COVID conspiracy theories. Then obviously COVID ended. People went immediately onto the Ukrainian war because that happened. And then after that, it became climate crisis and then the trans issue, and how people were just being radicalised through all of this, and how they were actually in these groups talking about attacking individual TDs and politicians. And we've seen that. And it was nearly like, if you read the report, it was nearly like a predictor of what happened. And then shortly after that report came out, we saw how quickly the Dublin riots reacted to the stabbing of children. And it, you know, it's there. And as Akira said, we have seen it happening in other countries. We have the history there. And now we have our own research in Ireland. The report Uisce Faoi Thála really outlines how this radicalisation is happening. And people may think it's a social media post. And I've seen it even on X this week, where people were saying, oh, people were arrested for speaking their mind and free speech. Calling for people to bomb somewhere is not free speech.
Killing Woods is an interesting piece by Alison O'Connor in the Sunday Times. She's having a should I stay or should I go now moment in respect of her own relationship with Twitter or with X. And she's just really, I suppose she's just trying to negotiate with herself. Here's something that I really, really find useful as a journalist, as a citizen. And should I stay or should I go? Because she is just sort of appalled at how, I suppose, just how the site has evolved under the leadership of Elon Musk.
And she caveats it in the same way that I would caveat to start off here, that I'm a journalist. I have about nearly 10,000 followers on Twitter, and I feel like I've built that platform up over a time. And it's just being upfront with it and being a bit vain. It'd be tough to give that up. I know people have much bigger followings than I do, and maybe some of it is wrapped up and they spent a lot of time building that follower base up. She doesn't quite go as far as saying she is considering leaving, but is saying it's a question that's on her mind. It's a question on my mind. I think about it a lot, but I think that's seeding ground. You know, like we're essentially in kind of a bit of a war on misinformation now. A lot of it's happening on Twitter at the moment, obviously due to change of ownership. That's happened or it's escalated since the change of ownership when Elon Musk took power of the company, and it's a completely different product. It is a definitively worse product than it was.
It's really interesting because we're not Colm O'Gorman struggling with this on our own. We mentioned the lead story in the Sunday Telegraph and Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, saying that they are now going to, and particularly I suppose in light of recent attacks in the UK, but that they are now going to revise or review their counter-terrorism strategy to include misogyny and violence against women and girls. And obviously we know there are huge consequences for, particularly against women and girls online, and how that can translate into real life. But what they're saying is it to target specifically the radicalization of young men by misogynistic influencers.
I mean, it's almost depressing to hear that that's now being only considered. I mean, when we look at the epidemic nature of gender-based violence and violence against women and girls across all of our societies going back many, many years, we need to understand and recognise that this is something that's both systemic at a societal and cultural level, that misogyny runs through and underpins many of the ways that we think about who we are as people and how we structure and organise our societies. We've never really done that. Now we're surprised somehow that where you get extreme misogyny, and by extreme misogyny, I'm going to assume that they mean the kind of posts that normalises or even calls for violence against women and girls, mm-hmm. not just the objectification
of women and girls, the incels,
but
the
violence
radicalization
against women and girls. Absolutely,
yeah.
That we're finally going to target that and address that. I do have some worries that really, I mean, you know, the Telegraph is the Telegraph. The story is really bigging up Prevent, which is this so-called counter-terrorism or anti-radicalisation programme that itself in the UK is very, very suspect and I think hasn't been very successful.
But Kira,
I do think addressing that kind of extreme misogyny and the radicalisation of young men, recognising, by the way, that many of the young men who were initially radicalised by people like Andrew Tate are now men in their 30s and mid-30s. They're not young men anymore.
But Kira, you know, you're talking about perhaps the inadequacy of a single approach, you know, the criminal justice approach, maybe taking a sledgehammer to crack a nut. But actually what the UK story does speak to is the role of regulation, you know, and this sort of battle, you know, with social media companies. There's quite a lot of, you know, stories in both the UK and Irish newspapers talking about that. And can that battle be won? And what is the role of regulation, because obviously since February we've had the Digital Services Act. Commissioner Mann is tasked with implementing that, but how do we take those social media companies on? You know, I read out one small example of a tweet, but what role does regulation have to play, and are they regulators sufficiently resourced to do what they need to do?
Yeah, I think there's lots of pieces to the puzzle. I think, you know, policing is part of it, regulation is part of it, and taking on the social media companies, I mean, that's an international conversation that's being had, and I think it's a very tough conversation that nobody's really got a very comprehensive answer to.
Services Act tries to, at a European level,
and maybe implementing that might not be, so maybe not more regulation, but actually implementing the regulation that we have. For me, a more interesting question is, you can kind of, you know, it's a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole. You can kind of win some battles, but if you're not dealing with why people are attracted to these organizations, and I think what Louise was saying was really interesting there, that it's kind of people are moving between conspiracy theories or between things. So you can kind of say, okay, now it's misogyny, now it's this. But what is the strategy to actually understand why young Irish people are so attracted to these extremist narratives? What fertile ground have we created? And to me, there's a lot of different stories there. It's a story about economics. It's a story about austerity. It's a story about housing. It's a story about, you know, the decimation of the community and voluntary sector and youth programs and drug programs over the last kind of 20 years that we're now trying to recover from. And I think also a vacuum of genuine political action. And I think part of the story for me is a real lack of education
and that's
in political education.
I wanted to bring Louise in on that, because actually for all of the coverage, and there's acres of coverage this morning, that bit about the education, whether it is education of society at large or, you know, changing those underlying attitudes and beliefs that actually give, I suppose, the ground for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what Kira was saying there as well about fertile ground. I think that's so important. I know that the EU are very, you know, very concerned about this type of thing as well, and trying to get people mobilised and improved engagement with the democratic process. So in Focus Ireland, we are undertaking a research project as part of, it's a project called Involve, which is an EU-funded group, and different countries around Europe are working with disenfranchised groups and trying to see how services are failing people and why they may potentially turn into this type of action. Now, they're not people who are involved in it, but they're groups that are disenfranchised and what can we do to improve the services. So in Focus Ireland, our group in Ireland, we're looking at lone parents who've experienced homelessness and housing issues. And that's obviously a big group. And we're working with Maynooth University, and our work will be then brought through the EU and working with that. And it's been really fascinating because I've been hosting the focus groups once a week with people and just hearing those insights. And honestly, some of the thoughts that they're, you know, some of their experiences, I can absolutely understand why, if I'm that disenfranchised, why I'm social media could answer me.
Colm, because I think maybe perhaps when you were speaking earlier about the reason why we're so surprised, you know, perhaps we think of ourselves as a kinder nation now. You know, we had the marriage equality campaign. You know, we had the repeal of the Eighth. We opened up to all these conversations, and we lulled ourselves into a false sense of security that we were maybe immune from some of those harsher conversations. But Louise talks about how you can go from feeling disenfranchised and then perhaps being drawn into those circles. It's a shorter journey than we think.
I think it's a shorter journey than we think for many reasons, and I would absolutely support everything that Louise has just said. And there are deeper issues also at play here that aren't just about disadvantage, for example. So first of all, many of the people who are leading out these very hateful campaigns, who are the people who are both leading these physically violent movements and calling them to be, are not young people. Like, this is not a phenomenon where we've got young people being radicalized. This is a phenomenon where we've seen people with deep-seated bigotry and prejudice being given permission to express, articulate, and put into action that prejudice in really gratuitous ways. We've lost, I think, in recent years, many of the kind of social controls or inhibitors that would have prevented that from being allowed to manifest.
And of course, one of the, as people often point out, you know, particularly in the UK and the US and in other countries, often it's politicians leading into conversations and then standing back when there are violent consequences.
We've been lucky here, Derville, that actually our political system hasn't really gone to that place. Like, we haven't seen, since for the last 20 years or more, we really haven't seen mainstream politics embrace prejudice to that degree where they've
not
fanned
here,
those flames.
In
Ireland, yeah, we might. But equally, what we're not doing, and I'll be quick on this point if I can, what we're not doing is we're not having the kind of conversation that maybe we could have, where we would normalise conversations around prejudice and bigotry and begin to understand and recognise that we all hold views that are grounded in prejudice and bigotry. We are the results of the societies that we grew up within, and we need to normalise those conversations so we're sensitive to it when we see it arise, including in our own attitudes and opinions.
Well, there must be a lot
and
of,
so that we, yeah, challenge it. Because in recent years, we've now gotten to a point in this country and in many, many other countries where it seems to be that the general opinion is that the victims of racism are actually racists and not the people who are subjected to racism. To accuse somebody of holding a prejudiced view is seen as the most awful insult you could ever accuse somebody of. And yet at the same time, we all hold views that are grounded in some kind of prejudice. We need to have those conversations.
A lot of people at home having huge conversations because the screen has kind of blown off here with messages. Sean in Celebrate says, free speech also implies responsibility for what one says, and you simply cannot continue with free speech without limits. He said, simply ban social media companies who won't moderate adequately. Another listener says, we need to debate social media and artificial intelligence as part of the next general election campaign, but many politicians as well as the wider public have limited understanding of the tweets. And finally, one says, Derville, I have a feeling that mental health issues are a big part of the problem. And Noel says, it's not true that everyone sees the posts of far-right groups on social media. Media outlets repeating the content of such posts aren't helping, and no, we don't need to know about them. That was what Noel said. Well, listen, we're going to take a very, very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very, very welcome back with me, Derv MacDonald, and joining me on the panel this morning are Louise Bayliss, Focus Ireland and founder of the single parent organisation Spark, Ciara Murphy, European Migration Network at the ASRI, Killian Woods, a senior business reporter with the Business Post, and Colm O'Gorman, Irish Examiner food columnist and human rights campaigner. I want to move on, Colm, to a really, really powerful piece in the Sunday Times from a young woman we did not hear from for many, many years. And it's Georgia Lillis, who is the daughter of Celine Cawley and Eamon Lillis. Talk us through it.
Yeah, Georgia was 16 years old when her mother, Celine Cawley, was beaten to death by Eamon Lillis. who subsequently, I think, was convicted of manslaughter rather than murder and served a relatively short sentence. I think
it was out in about
5 years.
Five years.
She's making a really important point. I mean, the headline is, "My father killed my mother. He should have lost his parental rights." And making the point that there's, in her view, and I do agree with her, something frankly obscene about the idea that somebody can kill another parent and still maintain total guardianship and parental rights over their child, including deciding whether or not they can get a passport, what school they can go to, all those kind of things. She also points out that in Ireland, given that upon his release, Eamon Lillis was reported to have secured nearly 1.5 million from his wife's estate, that in Ireland you can kill your wife and make a profit.
Yeah, it's really, she's calling for, she thinks that if a parent killed their partner, their guardianship rights should be automatically removed. But it's interesting, Louise, because it's in very, very difficult circumstances that you can actually have your guardianship rights revoked.
I think the whole issue around guardianship in Ireland needs a really frank conversation. Firstly, you know, you cannot remove a married parent's guardianship rights, and that can lead to post-separation coercive control, and it is quite damaging. And even one of the pieces in the article talks about how a parent can sexually abuse their child and still hold on to guardianship rights. And we do have a system, if a court granted guardianship, that they can remove guardianship, but you don't have it for the married parents. And also, even around guardianship, you know, since 2015, the cohabitation rules means that if two parents have lived together, the father does get automatic guardianship if he spent 12 months cohabiting with the mother of the child, three of them postpartum. But a lot of people don't seem to know that. So I know for a fact, a lot of lone parents sign the sole guardianship forms for passport when they're actually not sole guardians, but they believe they are. And one of the things that really upsets me is if you are a cattle, you are registered somewhere. If your car, you own a car, all the registered owners are there. We do not have that system for children and who the guardians are. And the passport office gets so complicated going, who's entitled to have the sole guardianship? All of those issues are there. And I think we need to have a really frank discussion about how guardianship is administered and if somebody is abusing that guardianship. And I think the simplest argument is to put it into the best interest of the child. And I think the whole piece of this conversation started around David French, whose sister was killed.
Valerie French Kilroy
was killed by the husband, James Kilroy, and he maintains his guardianship
right. Colm, he said it was actually David French who was Valerie French Kilroy's brother. He renewed calls for the introduction of laws to remove guardianship rights of parents who have killed their partners. But actually, one of the experts, Louise Crowley, was saying that we should look at circumstances where guardianship could be rescinded besides murder and manslaughter. Do you think, given the constitutional protection afforded to parents, that there would be actually a pushback against that if those rights could be interfered with in any other way?
I've no doubt about the fact that any suggestion that special status that's granted to parental rights in the Constitution, any suggestion that would be in any way weakened or watered down would receive fairly strong resistance from certain quarters. But let's set that aside for one moment and think about the real world impact of what we're talking about. I mean, absolutely, in these cases where a parent has killed another parent, that's a really obvious example. But in a case where a child has been sexually assaulted or sexually abused by a parent, the idea is somehow that child, until they're 18, needs that parent's permission to do fairly normal things in their lives. That parent will choose what school they can go to, whether they can leave the country, they can exercise all of the
same
parental rights.
Whether their surname can be changed.
All of these different pieces, it's fairly obscene. Yeah. And think about a situation where a child was horribly abused by both parents, which we've seen in Ireland on many occasions. Again, that child is left in a situation where the two people who horrifically abuse them have parenting rights over their children. And it's as Louise
only
pointed out...
Unless it's adoption, absolutely. Yeah.
But as Louise pointed out, automatic guardianship is granted to mothers on birth and to married parents and to fathers in certain circumstances, cohabiting situations now. Of course, it's time that we need to revisit that and have a conversation about that. Of course, we need to talk about what's going to be in the best interest of children in these particularly difficult cases. I get it's complicated. I guess it's going to unsettle people who are particularly concerned about parents' rights. But let's approach this from a children's rights perspective and make sure we get it right, because we can do that. It's
not beyond our way to do it. I think if as David French was hoping that his sister's death would be a turning point, but I think that's a fairly significant intervention today by Georgia Lillis. That was in the Sunday Times. Ciara, I wanted just to turn to an issue we never stop talking about, and that is housing, because there's quite a lot in the papers today, but one piece that caught your eye was Rory Hearn's opinion in the Irish Mail on Sunday. People need hope and houses, not skyrocketing property prices.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting, mainly because it talks about this report that was released by Savills during the week of just how severe Ireland's housing crisis is compared with other European countries. Because I've lived in quite a few different European countries, and lots of my friends that I talk to, they'd be like, oh yeah, we have a housing crisis too. And I'm like, no, not like we do.
We have a housing
crisis. Exactly. And it's great to have the numbers behind this now, but it's also just, it's such a depressing, the numbers in it are so depressing. And Ireland stands out alone in its severity, is a quote from the report. A 4-to-1 ratio of new houses for population increase. And I think, just the scale of it. And I picked as well this kind of piece on the tenant in situ scheme, because I think what is happening is that there's a lot of schemes that are announced that fiddle around at the edges. And I think what this shows is just the scale of how a complete transformation is needed in how we deliver housing. We're talking about a 256,000 housing backlog. And the ESRI recently came out with housing estimates basically saying, depending on international migration, between 35,000 and 53,000 new houses will be needed per year. At the moment, the targets are 33,000. So that's below even the lowest scenario of international migration, just to stay in the current level of housing
and
crisis.
And yet, Cillian Woods, if we needed to build all of those houses, we'd need to bring in people to build them. And I don't know where we would house them. Everyone has agreed in articulating the problem. But in terms of solutions?
Well, I suppose to counter that, the building sector would feel that they do have the manpower or the labourers to actually scale up to that level. Now, maybe that's what they would say, okay. But I know Michael Stanley from Cairn Homes has said that explicitly, that labour shortages are not a problem for them. Maybe they are for some small to medium-sized developers down the country. But I think we're getting a consensus now on that, how, and it's a useful piece of research that was done by Savills, because it kind of shows that we have, and it's been brought up by a few politicians, especially in government in the last while, that we do have a housing crisis here, but everywhere else does. It's a global phenomenon. It is good to get it in quantified terms, that for every 4 people that are added to our population and since 2015 to 2023, one house is built. Obviously, that ratio is narrowing because there are more houses built. We shouldn't have a 1-to-1 ratio there. So it is like that's not. It is alarming, and it is outside the norm of other kind of high income earning economies. But we do have a household size.
But it's part of that. When you look back to the global financial crisis, and we had a huge debt crisis. What, unemployment at 15%? Obviously, we'd then sort of flip that for full employment. Really, really strong economy. So it's just all coming together.
Well, that's the point of the system being completely broken. If there is, we're flush with cash, people are even building up savings during the pandemic, we apparently have this really high earning, good, let's say, tech jobs, just good jobs in our society, and people still can't afford to buy homes in cities or even buy homes on the fringes of cities to commute long distances in. That all just points towards it's been broken. And the Housing Commission probably delivered the biggest, most comprehensive report on showing how you could essentially start again.
Louise.
Well, obviously the housing crisis is massive, but I'm coming at it from a homelessness perspective, working in Focus Ireland. And the homelessness perspective is just, it's just getting worse by the day. We do believe homelessness can end. We have to not take the fatalistic approach that we can't end homelessness. Homelessness can end. And I'll point to during COVID, the measures that happened during COVID had a massive impact on reducing homelessness. So we know the solutions. There just isn't the will there to enforce these solutions that would work. I just had an analysis of the department's own official figures of homeless crisis. So in the first 6 months, there was an increase in the first 6 months of 985 people in emergency accommodation. And out of that, 708 of those people were in families. So that's
really... And the government would say that, well, while people were coming into the system, we were getting them out of it, but just the pace.
But the increase is now, this is an increase of 708 people out of 985. We're out of sync with the rest of Europe, where we have disproportionate homelessness among families. It's not single adults. It's not the single adult. And can I just say as well, really what's quite shocking is as well, is in lone parents. So in overall, there were 177 increase in families in emergency accommodation in the 6 months. Out of that 177, 134 were lone parent households. That's a serious crisis that needs to be looked at. The government have signed up to the Lisbon Treaty to end homelessness by 2030. We haven't seen their plan to do that. We need to see it, and we need to start thinking of solutions to end that.
Colin McGorman, when you came home from the UK yourself, you were exiled back home to North Wexford in order to be able to afford to buy a home. But your daughter now is away in Australia, like many young Irish people. Is housing maybe a deterrent factor with her generation for coming back?
Undoubtedly. I mean, first of all, I think, again, this is another narrative that we've always, I think, become a little bit immune to, the notion of a housing crisis. I actually think we need to acknowledge that we have now a housing catastrophe in this country. It's no longer just a crisis. We've moved way beyond that. And for years, we've been talking about people emigrating to find work or to find a better standard of living. Now people are emigrating because they simply can't afford to work and live here. We have a situation where we have full employment. But even in a country that's awash with cash, where we have full employment, where people are being paid good wages very often, people can't afford to rent very ordinary accommodation. Nothing extravagant, nothing ridiculous. I mean, most young people now, the age of 25, they have very little chance to get on the property ladder. Our daughter's 25. She went down to Australia mainly for social reasons, frankly, to get away from home after 3 years of a pandemic and to see a bit of the world and live something differently. She's now living in Melbourne. It's not a low-cost place to live. Rents are high there, but they're nothing compared to here. She's been there now for 2 years, and she just told us recently she's coming back for Christmas, but just coming back for Christmas, and we're selling her car for her. It's fairly clear that this is going to become longer term. And housing is a big part of that. If you don't have any realistic option of having just a decent standard of living, a decent place to live, whether it's to rent or to buy, why would you come back to a country like this?
Killian,
and I do think when we think about the radical reset, if you don't mind me just saying this one piece, part of the difficulty is that we have commodified housing to such a degree that all of the solutions that we look to are largely profit-driven. And profit-driven systems exist to drive and maximise profits, not to drive and maximise access
well,
to housing.
Killian Woods, this is your
and terrain. They'll continue to do that. We need that kind of dramatic reset. They will continue to do that.
Yeah, Killian Woods, this is your terrain, and I'm not going to say you're going to defend all of the big developers, but you do talk to them a lot more than us. Rory Hearn, one of his suggestions, a 3-year ban on rent increases, temporary ban on no-fault evictions, vacancy tax with real teeth. Like, I mean, we hear these proposals all of the time. What about the role of those bigger companies in the Irish property market? And obviously they came in after the crash, but, you know, the vulture funds or the equity funds. Like, I mean, to what extent is that distorting the market? And what can we do?
I don't think we do actually have big actors in the sector. When you think about like the biggest in the sector would be the likes of Glenbeigh and Cairn Homes, the LDA as a state actor.
But when you see entire apartment blocks that you cannot buy, that you're only going to be able to rent in them.
But I don't think we have big actors enough to influence the sector. These are building only a couple of thousand, max 2,000 a year. They're looking to scale up more. The problem is we don't have big developers that actually can come into the market to solve the problem, that can scale, can double capacity within a couple of years. I suppose Cairn and Glenbeigh would like to do that. Maybe it wouldn't be in their best interest in the current market to double supply at that. But there's one thing that Colin pointed out there is that as well, like your daughter's moved to Melbourne. Not to be controversial, a better city than Dublin. And Dublin and other cities that Dublin's compared to and other Irish cities are compared to, like New York, and say, well, rents are high there.
It's
New York. New York is an income. Like, it's not fair to compare Dublin on Dublin to compare it to New York or compare it to Melbourne.
So who should we compare to?
Other small-sized European cities.
Birmingham, like small Manchester.
Yeah,
Manchester's too big. We should also compare to reasonable standards. If you're living in a society where you're working hard, where you're generating a decent income and you can't afford to house yourself in a decent way, then there's a major problem. And Killian, I understand absolutely what Killian's saying about the absence of maybe large players, but those large players have a purpose. Their purpose is to create profit. That's a perfectly reasonable purpose. I'm not having a go at them for that. That's a perfectly reasonable purpose for a corporate actor. But if we continue with the system where the only motivation to provide housing is to create significant profit, how are we ever going to see a reduction in...
Well, they've already been priced out of the market. It has gotten to such a broken profit model that the international funds are not active in the market at the moment. That would be an example of how...
Kira, you were one of our wild geese and you've come home. What do you think?
I mean, I think there's a few things. Housing was a big part of my decision coming home. I was like, can I, you know, I was living in Geneva where the rents are incredibly high.
But expensive.
But no, sorry, not, you know, they're the same as here, except in Geneva, you have stability of tenure. You know, you're not going to get kicked out anytime soon because you know, you don't have a massive demand for first time buyers trying to buy housing. People buy them as investment properties. You have a stable rental market. Also, and this is something that I think is such an important point, in part, people want to buy in Ireland, partially for security, but partially because the rental market is not a professional rental market. Mm. Landlords treat houses like their houses that they're letting you stay in. In Geneva, it's your home. It's your, you know, you get to decorate it. You get to paint the walls. You get to go in and say, this is my home. This is my place. I know I'll be here for quite a long time. And I think the culture of renting is something that's so different here, where, you know, it's really like a favor that you're living there. And I'm like, I'm sorry, this is my home. And I'm going to be here for a long time. And I just think that's such an important
part of the story. Our listeners are very engaged on this issue. Mike says, my daughter is a qualified teacher in her 20s. She moved to a European country. She was made permanent after 2 years and she's now buying her own home there. That would never happen here. Somebody else says, why does nobody discuss introducing a temporary moratorium on buying a second home? it wouldn't fix the market, would help. It would also send the country into absolute meltdown. But Louise, your own son couldn't afford in Ireland, did he?
Yeah, no, my own son, when he qualified for his degree, he worked here for 2 years. And realistically, it was a case of living at home with mammy or moving out of the country to have that sense of independence. He moved to Malta at the time. There was a lot of people moving to Malta because as Brexit happened, they were looking for English speaking countries and he was in the tech industry and he moved to Malta. And I was just talking to him on Thursday and because he's put his deposit on his first home over in Malta, so there's no chance of him returning anytime soon.
Yeah. But another one says, Robbie, listener says, Killian, my son is a qualified plumber. He's well paid, but we can't see anywhere where he could buy a house. I don't see him coming back. I'm a teacher and I cannot see how young teachers can work and have a decent standard of living here. You know, and we're seeing all of these reports that, you know, people are going to be going back to school, that we don't have enough teachers. Are you, you're sort of in the buying but staying with the in-laws for now market?
Yeah, so we're living in my wife's parents' place. We lived in New York for 2 years between 2021 and 2023. We're at home just over a year now. I've been pretty much looking since then. We're looking in Galway City. There's only really secondhand properties there to look at. If it's new builds, the local authorities or the state's buying them. No one's building speculative apartments blocks. No one's building new homes in the city. So we're looking at secondhand, and you're looking at pretty much essentially looking to get a doer upper.
And then even if you do get hold of a doer upper, you can't get anyone.
Because I floated a few of the specs for houses around with like different contractors and said, look what sort of rough price for doing this house up and when can you do it? And they say 9 months, 18 months. And I'm not quoting your price now because inflation. I can't give you a rough estimate even within the 50 grand region because it could change wildly.
And then the problem is there you go out and you get a mortgage for the doer upper and a year down the line that mortgage is not adequate for the doer upper because you can't.
Yeah. Akira, another listener says, I'm a full-time lecturer and I can't afford a home in Limerick. It is so frustrating. Mm.
I actually wanted to fight with one of the points that Killian said there.
Please do.
Earlier, where he said we don't need a 1-to-1 ratio of population increase to homes. We actually probably need less than that. Germany has a 0.9 something to one person ratio because we are dealing with such a backlog of demand. And everything that we are talking about here is a massive backlog in demand. You know, so I do think we don't need to build 2.4 houses for every, you know, or a house for every 2.4 people. At the moment, we need a massively ambitious program to actually deal with all of this backlog of demand. Because at the moment, we're basically running, you know, we're running to stay, to keep going backwards. That's what's happening in the current policy.
So before we go to the ad break, what is the, there's probably not a silver bullet, but what do you think are going to be the big steps we need to take?
I mean, it's a total rethink of how the state builds housing and the state involvement in the market. You know, the institutional investors, the private sector is a really important part. Individual house builders, massive part of the story in Ireland. But if you want a functioning housing market, the state needs to intervene more so that you're kind of saying, okay, the private sector, the people who are working for profit, are doing the ones that are very profitable, but not all housing that a country needs to function
because,
is really profitable.
Because, Colm Gorman, it is a bit ironic that it is the social housing built in the 70s that are now being bought for crazy sums by the people, as Cillian pointed, working in those high-end tech jobs. But there is a two-tier because it's those jobs, those big multinational paying jobs that obviously are very, very welcome in terms of incomes and the salaries, but that's what's actually pushing the divide.
Look, you always see that. You always see an element of, I mean, it can be called gentrification, can't it, sometimes, right? Where areas that were traditionally working class or poor areas where lots of social housing was in place, particularly in an urban setting, get changed because the profile, the demographic shifts. However, if the state, and it's back to what Ciara is saying, is the state is then not stepping in to replace that housing stock and to put in place adequate housing stock from a social housing perspective, an affordable housing perspective, then you're on a hiding to nothing. We do need that rapid reset. The state does need to be much more engaged. And again, I'm not anti-profit. I'm not anti that kind of speculation. That's absolutely fine. It's part of the mix, as you say. But if we don't, I mean, I think in the run-up to the next election, we really need to be hearing from all the political parties about their realistic plans that are costed and that are radically different from a policy perspective for how they will provide 50,000
housing units per year. But isn't that the problem,
Cillian,
that they're not radically different?
But we need to talk about the numbers need to be different as well. They need to be at the 50,000 a year and they need to be realistic.
Again, isn't enough. I mean, you know, you're talking about the ESRI saying in a high migration scenario, you'll need 53,000 a year to keep up with new demand, literally to stand still.
Cillian, are there any, obviously everyone's in agreement on the problem, there's a little bit of difference amongst the political parties on how much they would deliver, but what are the radical solutions? Will I spur your blushes and take an ad break? Let's take an ad break. He has no answers. We'll take a quick break. Well, now, when you were making the cup of tea, Cillian Woods of the Business Post came up with all of the solutions to the housing crisis. Cillian, I'm sorry I cut you off there before the break.
And threw me under. Like, the bus doesn't do it justice. So the question, I think, look, if people want to ask politicians on the doorstep is, are they happy for house prices to fall? That's the question we need to talk about, because that was what I see underlying all of it. It's this, just they're terrified of doing anything that would see house prices fall.
But Louise, wasn't this where Mary Lou McDonald faltered when she later corrected it? But when she first came out and said, and are we part of that? Because when she said she'd like to see the average, you know, price in Dublin, was it 360 or 300, fall to that?
Yeah.
And everyone was kind of like, oh, no, you can sort the housing crisis, but not whilst devaluing the property or the value of my home.
I was quite shocked by people's reaction, because personally, I couldn't give a hoot about what my house is worth. To me, it's a roof that has covered my children and kept them safe. I have a 16-year-old daughter at home. Whether the house is worth 500,000 or 100,000. No, I do understand that. I do understand the banks care, and I do understand the idea of negative equity. And at times I was in negative equity myself. When I first took out the mortgage and the property crisis in 2008, I was in huge negative equity. But my point is that it's a cycle. And if you got a mortgage you can afford, whether you're in negative equity or not, it doesn't really make a difference. The value should be seen in what's the
But doesn't it speak to what Ciara was speaking about earlier, is that so much of our personal wealth is tied up in home ownership, and it is a valid aspiration for many people, Ciara.
I mean, it is, but you know, it's a very Irish approach to wealth. And since the 1950s, we've had this kind of welfare state through property, essentially. But I think it's really interesting. It's just politically so contentious, because once you buy a house, once you're in, all of a sudden your interest is in kind of maintaining the status quo. But I think one really important point is that house prices have increased by something like 9% in the last year. I mean, even just stopping that would be progress. So house prices are now 10% higher than they were in 2007 at the height of the property boom. I mean, it's crazy.
But if we think about,
are we having those? It feels a little bit like 2007 all over again. I can't be here for that.
But if we think about what we're obsessed with acquiring that kind of wealth for, to do what? I mean, you're quite right. A house, once you buy it and live it is your home. Most people will live in it hopefully until they die, at which point it gets sold and the state gets 33% of whatever's left before you hand it over to somebody else anyway. So this notion of it being a source of wealth is, for most people, a bit of a nonsense.
But I would also add that there's a huge crisis with pensioners, because we are getting a generation who will never own their house. And, you know, the pension was designed that most people would have a social house.
Intergenerational mortgages.
Idea that you would be a pensioner on your €265 and trying to pay rent on that, that's quite scary.
Just be clear, it is government policy to maintain the house price. Not that the government policy and all they're geared towards is, instead of reducing house prices, it is giving more money to buyers to buy them and bridge. They're not trying to bring the gap. There's a gap between what people can afford and what is actual price. They're not trying to bring the price down to what people can pay. They're trying to bring people up to the price.
So is that corporate welfare?
It's winning votes is what it is.
And it's corporate welfare, because we're injecting money in to pay property prices that are unrealistic and unsustainable.
It's a drastic intervention in a private market.
Because this is all quite depressing, Ciara, the Sunday Independent has a bizarre little story by Lorna Siggins that a certain animal could shine a light on depression. What is it?
So, yeah, I just really loved this little story. The headline is Zebrafish Study Could Help Shine a Light on Depression. And it's about funding that's been received by a lecturer at UCC, Dr. Jatin Nagpal, to basically study the determinants of depression using a zebrafish. And I think what really caught my eye was this first line, that basically fish can suffer from depression, especially if they're confined to boring tanks with few plants or other stimuli. And I'm really interested in
Your brain brought you to Ireland's housing crisis, and that is a symptom of just how endemic it is. Kelly, you also had an animal related story about furs in.
Oh, yeah. I'm cynically, you look at the, as a journalist, you look at papers and you try to think, what could I learn from this? What could I bring to my job? And it seems to be that if you want to get a top class interview with someone who doesn't talk, ask them about their dog. So Vogue have gone to they're launching this kind of quiet season. How would you pronounce it? If it's Vogue, it would be Dogue, like D-O-G-U-E. And it's that they've never had a higher response from like requests for interview or requests from like celebrities to talk to them than when they've asked them, will you talk about your dog? So maybe I should be asking the people who won't talk to me about their dogs.
Well, maybe actually the key to it, I wonder, does Grainne Shoga have a dog that she wants to bring out? Because celebrities, Colm O'Gorman, running for elections, we're cynical about it, but it's working for some.
Do you know, you have to look at who the person is, I think. Like, I heard somebody talking about this during the week, and they pointed out that Grainne Shoga is obviously somebody who has a deep, deep understanding of the Irish language. She would be running in Éamon O'Caoimh's constituency, where Irish language issues are obviously very important.
She's a serious broadcaster.
She has a profile. She has lots of experience, both in terms of media and business and other spaces. I think she's a very credible and a serious candidate. I do think there's a bit of a dismissal of her because of who she is. Because she is a woman, and because she is the type of woman that she is,
it's refreshing, particularly as reference our discussion earlier that any woman would be considering coming into politics. That's obviously one.
It's a brave step on her part. Yeah. But look, celebrity or well known or people with profile entering politics is nothing new.
Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump,
Jack Lynch. We've had many, many people get involved in politics from all kinds of walks of life. Frankly, I mean, we probably need fewer teachers and lawyers in politics and more people coming in from lots of
diverse backgrounds. What is a bit cynical is to come out of the woodwork at this stage. Well, like I think
she hasn't yet come out herself.
Tell that to the papers. I live in Galway, and there are, well, I'm surprised in our area there was young councillors in their early 20s going for both Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil, and they'd stuck with a party that wouldn't be exactly the most favourite with the rest of their age cohort.
But are we too cynical about people who want to come forward into political life, and especially if you're a councillor, they can be thankless roles, thankless tasks. So should we not, Ciara, be welcoming people coming in, whether they've a profile or not?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to see, you know, we talk about diversity in politics. I'd love to see diverse backgrounds in politics. Mm. I think it's a really, it's really important. And it's really, you know, also important for young women to see other young women getting into politics. I think that's a big issue. But also just people who, like I said, I think our political education and kind of sense of political efficacy is quite low for me compared with other European countries. Like you look at kind of the French education system and it's very much the same kind of, you see the same backgrounds and the same kind of, you know, like line to get into politics. So I think more diversity is great.
Louise.
Yeah, I'm kind of caught between both of the ideas because in one sense I see what Colm is saying about Grainne Shoga, not to pick on one person, having, you know, a lot of attributes that would make her well suited for the role. But then the other side of it is she's never expressed a political interest before, and it's this idea.
Do you need to?
This idea that you can become a politician just because you want to speak or you're a good communicator, and a politician should be more than just a good communicator. And I think we've seen a lot of communicators in the Dáil rising up through the ranks, and they're not necessarily good at implementation, and we need people who are on the ground, have done the work and are good at implementing, and that's what I'd be pushing for.
I think diversity is incredibly important.
Very important.
I don't want to focus in on
diversity
the suggesting.
Colm O'Gorman dogs. That's all we have time for because it's coming up to 12 o'clock. With me were Colm O'Gorman, Killian Woods, Kira Murphy and Louise Bayliss. Thanks for being in the panel today.